Andrew told me I need to open this episode with an explicit warning before I start dropping F-bombs, so here it is. This episode is explicit and it has spoilers. Now, here's the opening that I wanted. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
You literally can't talk about Die Hard without saying that phrase over and over and over.
No, you can't. So welcome to the Lit Flicks podcast, episode 5. We are books, movies, booze. So we read a book, we watch a movie, we basically get drunk, and we talk about it.
Here we are.
I am Casey.
I'm Abby.
And tonight's episode is Nothing Lasts Forever, aka Die Hard by Roderick Thorpe, published in 1979. The movie was released in 1988, starring Bruce Willis and the late, great Alan Rickman.
The human god, Alan Rickman.
And I don't know what you're drinking tonight, but I am having a Holly Jolly Punch, and it is amazing and delicious, and it tastes like the holidays.
What do the holidays taste like?
They taste like deliciousness and nutmeg.
But not, okay, when you said holidays, I imagine like tree sap and candle wax. That's not right.
No, okay. I did not put tree sap and candle wax in my drink. Okay, so it's triple sec, vodka, cranberry juice, ginger ale, orange juice, and nutmeg.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
It's really good. I really like it.
Yeah, I want to try that. I'm dripping. I'm drinking a Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. And it's, you're supposed to use rum, I think, but I hate rum, so I didn't. It is eggnog with whiskey. And you're probably, I added a scoop of vanilla ice cream and I blended it. So it's kind of like a milkshake.
I don't know how I feel about that.
I take back every bad thing I said about creamy alcohol because this is really good.
Do you? My mom was just telling me her best friend, instead of putting milk in pancakes, she put eggnog in them.
What?
And she said it's life changing.
I didn't even know you were supposed to put milk in pancakes.
Okay.
I have the just add water only kind.
Okay.
Are we talking homemade pancakes here?
I believe so.
Some like roadside flapjacks.
I wonder how it'd be on French toast.
I think it's good. I think I've done it.
Okay. I'm glad you don't know what you've eaten.
Well, now I'm having French toast tomorrow for breakfast.
Excellent. Yum. You're a big breakfast person though.
Oh my fucking God. I could eat breakfast all day, every day for the rest of my life.
If we're going out to breakfast, I try to make sure it's late enough I can order lunch because I am not a breakfast person. It's
the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard in my life.
Okay.
I go to places and I'm like, are you still serving breakfast? I know it's 5 p.m., but I need some maple syrup in my life.
No, I'm like, I know it's 8 o'clock, but I really want a BLT.
That's great. All right.
Yeah.
So we should both go to IHOP because I think we'd make it there. I think we would be okay.
Okay. I used to hate when people would ask me if I want to go out to breakfast because no, I don't want to go.
I took you out to breakfast like when you first moved that one time.
Oh, we went to brunch. That was different.
And I think you didn't get a whole lot of breakfast items.
No, I didn't. And I also ordered alcohol. So.
Well, obviously.
I feel like brunch is different.
Okay.
I don't know why.
I still can't get over the fact that you hate eggs. That makes me sad. And
oh my gosh, I hate them so much. Like the smell of them makes me want to vomit.
Once again, I could eat eggs every meal. Anyway.
Gross. Anyway, do you want to hear about our author?
Yes, I do.
All right. So Roderick Thorpe was born in 1936 in Bronx, New York. Bronx.
Is it the Bronx or Bronx?
It said Bronx.
Like when you're writing on an envelope, do you say the Bronx or do you say Bronx?
I feel like it's Bronx.
I think you're right. Okay. I'm just going by J-Lo on the block or whatever the fuck.
J-Lo on the block? Okay. After graduating college in 1957, he sold cars. He worked at a haberdashery.
You have to wear a bow tie and suspenders at that job, don't you?
I believe you do.
What's a haberdashery?
I believe. Okay, so there's two different things in.
There's two schools of thought.
No. Sorry. So a haberdashery in Europe sells like sewing accessories.
Ah.
and one in the US, I believe, is more men's fashion and accessories.
Fashion.
Like men's custom suits.
Oh, okay. So yuppie shit.
Yes. He also worked in insurance.
That is the most noble profession.
Yes, it is.
Also requires a bow tie and suspenders.
Yes, it does. And
golf and scotch, as evidenced by the Gilmore Girls.
He worked for his father, who owned a detective agency for 9 years. And while working there, one time he spent a week lying under a bus, spying on a mechanic selling stolen gasoline. He continued to work at his father's detective agency until he sold his second novel, which was The Detective.
That's a really creative title.
And The Detective was made into a movie starring Frank Sinatra.
Here's my question.
Yes.
I'm just rewinding like just a smidge. Okay. So your dad owns a detective agency, yet you fuck around with the haberdashery. Why weren't you at the detective agency all along?
I don't know. Okay, sorry. I would be so into nepotism. I don't know.
You'd be down with the nepotism.
Yes, 100%. Pass me on a business, peeps.
Yeah, exactly.
So 4 of his novels were actually adapted. 2 were adapted for TV movies and 2 for the big screen. He died of a heart attack in Oxnard, California in 1999, and he was only 62 years old.
There's no more beautiful name for a town than Oxnard.
I don't even know where it is.
It's in SoCal.
Okay.
It's south of Santa Barbara, but north of Los Angeles on the 101 freeway. There's a lot of mushroom farms out there. I know, because I could smell all the shit fertilizer when I lived there.
Nice.
When there was a nice east wind. That's what you get when you live in Ventura.
That's funny. Okay, so Roderick Thorpe originally wrote Nothing Lasts Forever as a sequel to The Detective, so that it could be made as a follow-up film with Frank Sinatra. And the main character in there is Joe Leland. Frank Sinatra actually had first refusal to any sequels.
What is first refusal? That means like you offer it to me and I don't take it?
Yeah, so it's automatically yours unless you don't want it.
Oh, got it.
But it can't go to anybody else before you.
But you have the right to turn it down.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if Frank Sinatra would have said yes, he would have been 73 at the time that this movie was made.
That's way too fucking old.
Okay, that's what I thought too. However, then I looked up, Bruce Willis is actually in production for another Die Hard and he is 63 years old.
63 is not 73, but...
Okay, however, I mean, you're pushing up there.
Yeah.
Can you run stairs anymore? How fit are you?
Are we insulting like a lot of 63-year-olds right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, I think we are.
Okay.
I'm so sorry.
It is a question because I can't run upstairs right now, so...
I mean, the struggle is real. This movie was directed by John McTiernan, who also directed Die Hard with a Vengeance. And let's see, he also did The Hunt for Red October, which I do like that movie a whole lot.
Sean Connery, right?
Yes.
Nice.
So there were 2 writers on this, Jeb Stuart, who also wrote The Fugitive, ooh, and Stephen D'Souza, who wrote Die Hard 2.
Didn't Roderick Thorpe help to write this movie?
I don't know that he worked on the screenplay.
Okay. Can I look that up real quick?
Yeah.
Just to make sure.
Yeah. I thought they just took it from his book.
Yeah, you're right. I could swear somewhere I read that he was involved in the writing of the movie, but I could just be, my brain could just be filling in blanks.
Okay. I hadn't heard that.
Okay. Sorry, okay. I didn't mean to throw you off. Continue.
So the role for this movie was actually offered to quite a few different actors, and they eventually got down to Bruce Willis, who was mostly known as a comedic television actor at the time. This completely changed his career, obviously. And while he was filming Die Hard at night, he would film the show Moonlighting during the day.
Oh, okay. Long days.
And I have never seen that show. Have you?
No, I've never watched it.
Okay. I think that's part of why he looks so tired in this movie.
Well, it works because I think that's supposed to come through from the book, too. So
this was Alan Rickman's first feature film. He was 41 years old. He had been performing on stage and television, but this was his first on screen, like on, yeah, feature film.
He was a born actor.
Man, I love him.
I just love that he didn't find his groove until he was in his 40s. Like, how fucking cool is that? Like, right? You don't have to know what everything at when you're 25.
No, you don't. The other day we were watching Love Actually, and I'm like, hey, Hans Gruber. And my husband was like, no, it's not. And I was like, yes, it is.
He didn't believe you?
He didn't even recognize him at all.
Well,
and I was like, Alan Rickman is great. So
he's a chameleon. Like I said, he's a human god. I love him.
He's so great. I love him as Snape as well.
Someone might think you're up to something.
He's so fantastic.
Love him.
Before we get into the plot of this movie, I just wanted to take a second because I laid out a case for why this is a Christmas movie, and I will defend this to the death.
Okay, I'm right here with you. I'll be your supporter.
I didn't realize what a huge debate this was online until I kind of started looking into it, and I guess everyone has a different opinion.
That's dumb. If you don't think this is a Christmas movie, you're stupid.
Okay, why do you think this is a Christmas movie, or do you just want me to say why it is?
I can say why I think it is as, like, an innocent bystander here.
Okay.
It's got... You're traveling for Christmas. That's like the number one.
Yep.
It's got Christmas lights. It's got Christmas music. It has a Christmas fucking, maybe a Christmas party, sort of.
Okay.
Also, I think one of them says ho, ho, ho in it.
He writes it on a guy's shirt.
That's right. Ho, ho, ho.
I saw people saying... The reason it's not a Christmas movie is the same reason why Iron Man 3 and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang are not Christmas movies. And same with Eyes Wide Shut.
I've never seen
Eyes Wide Shut. Is that a Christmas party? Okay. Anyway.
Eyes Wide Shut, all of the action doesn't revolve around it being Christmas time, though. It's not the impetus for everything that happens, right?
I don't know. I haven't seen that movie forever.
I know. All I remember is masked orgies, so I don't know. I mean, I know what I'm doing this Christmas.
I mean, isn't that what you do every Christmas?
That's what I do every weekend.
Okay. I do also want to point out that the main character in this movie is not the main character. His wife is named Holly. Hello, Christmas name.
Oh, Holly. Yeah.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. Okay, so I wrote down some classic holiday tropes from movies. One, greedy villain. Check. Two, seeing family. Check. Christmas music and decor. Check.
Check, check.
Realizing family is the most important thing. Check. A holiday transformation in a main character. Check.
Check.
And it snows during the final scene. I know it snows money in this, but check.
That is amazing.
The other argument I have is that... What is my other argument? So this movie works outside the confines of Christmas, but I think it means more within those confines.
Yeah, I get that.
And... Mm-hmm. Same with Home Alone, and Home Alone is just Die Hard for children, so.
It literally is. That's such a good comparison. Never would have thought of that. Oh, my God.
It 100% is.
The burglars are the terrorists. They're greedy. Uh-huh. Oh, my God.
Right? They just made Die Hard for kids. They're like, let's have everyone love this movie.
That is so heartwarming.
Oh, Macaulay Culkin.
Did you know he was in The Nutcracker before Home Alone?
I did not know that.
I only found that out this year. I was like, Macaulay Culkin was even more of a baby in that. I thought he got Nutcracker because of Home Alone, but that was incorrect.
That's interesting.
Fun fact.
So at his roast at the very end of it, Bruce Willis says it's not a Christmas movie, but I feel like he's just trolling everybody, and it is. Then the writer, John DeSouza, says that it is a Christmas movie, and he has a beautiful diagram that I'm going to put in our show notes that compares it to White Christmas.
I've never seen White Christmas.
Oh my God, I hate you right now.
I'm sorry.
The other argument kind of against it was this movie was released in maybe July.
Why do they do that? They did that with Hocus Pocus, too. Hocus Pocus, I think, was released in July, and that was the dumbest fucking thing in the world.
Well, Miracle on 34th Street was released in May.
But that was in the 30s. Nobody cared.
40s.
I mean, the 40s. People didn't go to movies back then.
I feel like that's false.
I think that's wrong. Anyway.
I don't think you're right there. Yeah, it was released July 20th. There you go.
Die Hard was?
Die Hard was.
Why would they do that?
I don't know.
Do they think people only want to see action movies in the summer?
I don't know.
Fuck you, Hollywood. Give me more credit than that. Okay.
All right. The only other thing I want to say before we really get into this, I just want to... Two things, I guess. First, we're going to do things a little bit different on this episode. We usually go over the plot of the book and then interject notes from the movie. But this time we're going to do the plot of the movie and interject notes from the book. I think everyone's seen this book or this movie. Everyone's seen this book. And so, yeah, we're going to do things a little bit backwards. I think it'll still work just fine.
The other thing is the book is so stream of consciousness that it's like impossible to track plot wise.
It really is. The other thing I just want to get out of the way. This book is sexist and racist. And so,
yes,
there's my warning. If you don't want to read it, there's, you know, stuff that doesn't go great in there.
There's a lot of jive talk. But here's the thing. There's a lot of jive talk in Stephen King books, too. I'm not defending racism. I'm just saying we're going to come across it when we read books that were written in the past. And even now. So
this book and this movie has its issues. You know, it's there.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we're not okay with it.
We're not okay with it. That's not what I meant. Right. I meant like, okay, we can move on.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I know what you meant.
Okay. I was going to say, are you ready to get into the plot?
I sure am.
All right.
So our movie starts out on Christmas Eve. NYPD detective John McClane arrives in Los Angeles intending to reconcile with his estranged wife, Holly, at the Christmas party of her employer, the Nakatomi Corporation. McClane is driven to the party by a young gentleman named Argyle, who's the cutest little limousine driver I've ever seen. An airport limousine driver. While McClane changes clothes, the party is disrupted by the arrival of a German terrorist named Hans Gruber and his heavily armed team. Carl, Tony, Franco, Theo, Alexander, Marco, Christoph, Eddie, Uli, Heinrich, Fritz, and James. Poor James. He's the only one that's like, I'm from Texas. The other ones are all exotic.
Oh, and Carl is with a K.
Yeah, Carl and Christoph.
Carl. Yeah.
One of these fucking guys looked exactly like Jeffrey Dahmer, the cannibal. Did you pick up on those glasses?
No, but I'm happy that you had to add in that he was a cannibal because nobody's ever knew that Jeffrey Dahmer was a cannibal.
I feel like we focus so much on cannibals on our show that we just have to bring it up at least once a show.
I made a comment about something with the Donner Party tonight, and Andrew was like, you mean Dahmer? And I was like, nope, other cannibal.
Oh, Jesus Christ. The Dahmer
the
Party.
The other cannibals I talk about.
Okay, I'm getting a picture of a musical in my mind right now called The Dahmer Party. That would be so much fun.
It mixes penises in a drawer in a cabin in the woods on a snowy mountain.
Oh my God, so gross. And the audience sits in covered wagons.
I'm so happy right now. That was really funny.
Revolutionary.
I like the picture going on here. Okay.
Do you have anything here? Do you want me to keep going?
You can keep going for a moment.
The group seizes the tower and secures those inside as hostages, except for John McClane, who slips away. and Argyle, who unknowingly gets trapped in the fucking garage.
I love that he just parties down there the whole movie.
Why is he sitting down there for all that time?
I don't know. Would you sit and wait for somebody that long?
No, I think he was supposed to be somewhere else, too. I remember him calling someone.
I get real pissed if I'm waiting for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, I have a really hard time waiting. So I wanted to say, and I think we both probably wanted to say, that we have to address right off the bat that the characters in the movie deviate a lot from those in the book.
Yes, they do.
They have similar characteristics. Some have similar motivations, not all of them. And their names mm-hmm. and relationships tend to be pretty different from the book.
Yes. Do you want to explain those?
I mean, I'm not going to tell all of them right here because that would be really boring, I think.
How about top three?
Okay, number one, Joe Leland.
Becomes John McClane.
Becomes John McClane.
In the book, he's in his mid-50s,
probably. Yeah, in the book, he's in his mid-50s. In the movie, what would we say? He's 40, 30-something?
I would put him in his 30s.
Yeah, which is weird to think Bruce Willis is the same age as us. That's odd to think about. Oh, anyway. Because he's the dad you want to bone, but I can't, like... Like, from Armageddon?
Speak for yourself. I don't feel that.
You don't think he's attractive at all?
I think this is another, like, Giovanni Ribisi situation. Oh, fuck.
And I think Bruce Willis is pretty short, too, so I'm right on track there.
Okay, I'm glad he fits into your type.
But, like, not even in Armageddon, when he's the hot dad? Never mind. Sure. Let's continue.
Sure.
So Joe Leland sounds like an old dude's name, and so they switch it to John McClane. I don't know why, but it sounds cooler and it feels younger. Mm-hmm. Leland was a World War II vet, retired from the NYPD, and works as a consultant for the FAA? Question mark.
I believe so. He actually implements important procedural things.
That sounds like a very professional job title.
I'm a professional consultant. Take me seriously.
Can you fit that on a business card?
I'm getting some made up tomorrow.
Perfect. You're set. Your career.
It's just going to say, oh, no. I was going to say it's going to say I'm a professional, but that sounds like I'm a professional hooker. So...
I'm a pro, baby. They're called sex workers.
Okay, I apologize.
So I only put Joe Leland in my notes. Do you want to take over?
Yes, I would like to say that Hans Gruber in the movie is little Tony the Red in the book. Mm-hmm. And in the novel, he is an actual terrorist, not a robber.
Right.
Not just a robber. Mm-hmm. The other major difference, well, there's two more. So Holly in the book is actually Stephanie Gennaro, Leland's daughter. Mm-hmm. She also has her kids at the party they're at.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
The other change that I still don't understand why they made this change in the movie, it's Nakatomi Tower. It's a Japanese company. In the book, it's Claxon Oil. It's very American, run by a Texan. I'm not sure why they changed it.
Well, I just think back to that scene in Back to the Future when Marty McFly is explaining to Doc how all the best stuff is made in Japan. I think maybe in the 80s, Americans have a real boner for Japan.
Okay.
That's just a guess. I still have a boner for Japan, but...
I'll go for it.
Yeah. That's just a guess, and it doesn't make sense. You're right.
A couple other differences. So, in the movie, they're obviously just thieves. Mm. Where, in the book, they have a cause. They are terrorists for a cause.
Yeah.
And I don't know... It brings up a whole, like, morality thing with me. In the book, I kind of see their side of it. Yes, what they're doing is wrong, but I see why they are doing it. Where in the movie, they're just thieves. And I mean, I love them because I have a thing for art theft. So
a big old thing.
Not in real life. I just have like a beautiful fantasy of stealing art. I'm not a thief.
Yet.
yet. Someday, watch out, everyone. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's there. Okay, so one interesting thing that does happen, and the reason that John McClane is barefoot through this movie, is he meets a gentleman on the airplane flying out to LA who tells him when he lands to make fists with his toes and it'll help refresh him.
Toe fist.
And the novel sets up a similar situation, but he kind of recalls in a flashback that this man told him. I don't think he tells him fists with the toes. I think he tells him when he lands to wash his feet. And that's like the end of it.
He says fist, toes, toe fists.
I don't remember that in the book.
I can't tell you what page it's on, but okay. I know it's there.
Okay.
He might have said something like curl your toes or some bullshit.
Okay. I think it sets up a great vulnerability throughout the book and the movie.
Ooh. Nice. Yeah.
So I think that's why it's there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I really like that.
All right.
Okay. So the female lead in this movie is named Holly Gennaro / McClane. She's John's estranged wife. And I personally love Holly. I think she's an amazing character. She's got nerves of fucking steel. Mm-hmm. I mean, she goes up against Hans Gruber and is like, here's the deal. You need to get this pregnant woman a fucking couch to lay on.
She's also great at deflecting sexual harassment.
Ooh, she is. She handles it like a pro. I mean, the fact that she has to deflect it and not like say, hey, that's totally fucking unacceptable.
Right.
It's very 80s. But yeah, she is she's like in control of herself and everything.
I think she handles it great.
Yeah. She's a super feminist character. Like I said, she stands up for her pregnant assistant like Sheryl Sandberg does. I also like that she wasn't painted as totally greedy like Stephanie was in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thoughts on Holly. I fucking loved her. Thought she was great.
Yeah, I like her as well.
Speaking of women, we have to address that none of the terrorists in the movie are women, where in the book there were at least a couple of women terrorists. So that's a total bummer. I really wanted to see some terrorist chicks get snuffed, and I was deprived.
I think they didn't do it, though, because it takes away from Bruce Willis's likability.
Oh, 100%. There's no way he could get away with that. And
no, I don't think audiences would feel the same about him.
No.
The novel is definitely much darker.
That is a fact. Yeah, I totally agree. They had to change it for a commercial audience. Otherwise, it would have been too heavy.
Right.
But I think that really says something about how fucking sexist our society is and how we see and tolerate violence against young men.
Mm-hmm. Women can be just as depraved.
Women can be just as depraved. And I'm sorry, but our young men are not expendable. Also. Don't send my son to war, please. I watched a thing about World War II and D-Day, and so now I'm like, please God, don't ever let conscription happen again. Okay, so
back to our story.
So I liked that Holly was not painted super greedy like Stephanie was. Holly's focus was on her career and her work, while Stephanie's focus was really on money. In the book, Leland says Stephanie makes $40,000 a year. Which is adorable.
Man, those were the days.
Right? So in today's money, that's somewhere between $128,000 and I think $140,000+.
That's a great salary.
It's a super sizable income, especially like I can't imagine making that much money. That's incredible. But she still ends up living beyond her means and is very focused on appearances. In the book, Stephanie buys herself this really extravagant watch as a reward for closing the deal that is the impetus for this, for all the action. But in the movie, the watch is bought for Holly by, is it by Ellis or is it by the Nakatomi Corporation?
I am not 100% clear on that.
Anyway, Holly doesn't buy the watch for herself. It's purchased for her. And downplays it.
She seems pretty embarrassed by it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the watch becomes a really important item for the book and the movie. Same scene for different reasons.
which we will get into later. Yes,
we will totally talk about that later. Do you have anything else right here?
No.
Gruber interrogates Nakatomi executive Joseph Takagi for the code to the building's vault and reveals that he plans to steal $640 million in bearer bonds, with the terrorist act merely a distraction, a cover, okay, if you will.
Can I stop you here? I did not know exactly what a bearer bond was. Like, I had some idea.
What the fuck is it, and does it still exist? Because I don't even know.
Okay. So a bearer bond is a bond or debt security that is issued by a corporation or a government. It is unregistered. There are no records kept of the owner or any of the transactions involving ownership.
So it's like cash.
So whoever holds the paper the bond is issued on owns it.
So it's like cash.
This was very useful for investors who wish to remain anonymous.
Oh.
Recovery of the value of the bearer bond in the event of loss, theft, destruction is virtually impossible.
Oh, wow.
These bonds have historically been the choice means for money laundering and tax evasion.
That adds a whole other...
So in response to all of this, issuance has been severely curtailed since the 80s. And all of the bonds that were issued by the U.S. Treasury have matured, so they no longer pay interest. As of May 2009, there's approximately $100 million outstanding.
That's really interesting. So does that mean, so that fact alone means that the Nakatomi Corporation was doing something super shady?
Probably. And it also means that there's no way of recovery if these are stolen.
Right. So insurance is not going to cover that shit.
No, not at all.
Cool. That is so badass.
I think it was a great turn to take. So, like, in the book, it is just actual cash. Mm-hmm. But who keeps cash now? Like,
also, we have no, like, in the book, we get a full explanation of the shady dealings that the Klaxon Corporation is doing. And in the movie, we don't really have that.
I just mean in the movie, how many corporations would have $640 million in cash lying in a vault? That's not exactly plausible. I don't think.
You're right.
So I think it's great that they have bearer bonds. And I'm very happy that I learned exactly what they were.
Fun fact. Okay. Do you have more here?
Nope.
Okay.
I was going to say fun facts with Casey.
Aw, I like that segment. Okay. Takagi refuses to cooperate and is killed by Gruber. McLean secretly watches. I think he's behind a desk, but accidentally gives himself away and escapes. He sets off a fire alarm in an attempt to alert authorities, so Gruber sends Tony to investigate. One thing in the movie here I thought was fun as he's running away is we get to see how many boobs are sprinkled throughout the film. So you've got the couple getting it on in the office at the beginning. So you see her tits out.
Boobs.
Bubes. Then there is the topless calendar hanging somewhere in like the hallways of the building, like the back hallways, like basically the back alleys of the building.
I understand why they put it there as like a reference point, but yeah. Is there nothing else they could have used, or do people only notice it because there's boobs?
I think it gets the human brain buzzing and it's like, ooh, that's something I don't expect to see. There it is.
Ooh, boobs. Look at me. Look at me.
I like that we really get to see the male influence in this movie.
It was definitely not directed by a woman.
Nope.
Or written by a woman.
Nope. I have in my notes, tits remind us where we are.
Tits will always bring us home. Tits up, baby.
Tits up.
The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That's all I have to say about tits for now.
Now streaming on Amazon.
Make sure you renew your Prime subscription, everyone.
This is not an ad. I am not being paid to say this.
Which is such bullshit. We should never say where we watch things ever again. Okay, so McClane kills Tony, pocketing his weapon and radio, using it to contact the LAPD.
Right here, just for 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. In the book, he has to, the radios don't have the range. And I don't actually know what the range on a radio is.
No.
But so he uses Morse code, blah, blah, blah. I actually read that Morse code is going to be a dead language, kind of like Latin. Oh. And only real enthusiasts use it. The
enthusiasts.
Enthusiasts?
There you go.
Not enthusiasts.
I mean, you can say it the other way. It's just funny.
Enthusiasts. Morse code enthusiasts.
Okay.
Still use it and learn it. But the U.S. Navy stopped looking for signals, like searching SOS signals in like 92.
What?
Yeah.
What if I was trapped? Stranded on a fucking raft in the middle of the ocean with nothing but a radio to click SOS, what would happen?
I don't know. Do you know how to click SOS?
I was gonna learn. But now I'm not gonna bother.
Okay, so this, when he contacts this, it actually brings up one of my favorite lines from the movie.
Ooh.
So he calls the dispatch and they think, dispatch, yeah. And they think it's all a prank.
And oh, they tell him,
they're like, this channel is only for emergencies. And he says, no fucking shit, lady. Do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza? And that's like such a great line.
That is a great line. It's one of those great action movie lines where it's just like, we're in it for the fun, you know?
This movie is so chock full of great one-liners. Like, I really like it.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch it again. And I'm glad that it's Christmas season, so I have an excuse to watch it over and over.
Yeah.
Okay. So, as Sergeant Al Powell is sent to investigate, Gruber sends Heinrich and Marco to stop McClane, who kills them both.
Pew, pew.
That sounded like Star Wars. Powell arrives and is greeted by Eddie, posing as a concierge. Finding nothing unusual, Powell prepares to leave, but McClane drops Marco's corpse onto his patrol car to gain his attention while Alexander shoots at the car from the building with an automatic rifle. Powell...
And, sorry, here's my next great line. Welcome to the party, pal.
Okay. And nobody can deliver it like Bruce Willis, let's be honest.
No, that wasn't anywhere near. It's so great.
Yeah. Powell summons the LAPD, who lay siege to the building. McClane steals Heinrich's bag containing C4 explosives and detonators. When Powell and Robinson's the douche cop. Mm-hmm. When Powell and Robinson is the douche cop.
The chief?
Deputy chief.
Okay. Is his name the same in the book? Do you remember?
I think it is, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
So they're talking about the body falling on the car. Robinson says, ew, it's probably a stockbroker who got depressed. Yeah.
Like normal.
Oh, yeah. That's totally the most likely explanation for this scenario. Mm-hmm. He is such 100%. A useless dick. I hate him.
He really is.
He's the worst.
The thing I liked about, well, that I thought was intriguing about the book, Leland was a fighter pilot in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So in the novel, every time he kills, this really seems to affect him. And he says that he's never seen someone killed up close. He's always been separated from it.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
And so it really does affect him. And you kind of see him detached throughout the novel, except when it comes to the women, mm-hmm. who he calls girls. And he says they're children because they're in their 20s.
Sorry, I don't know if that's just hilarious to me.
I mean, but anyway, I don't see Bruce Willis struggling with this in the movie.
No, he's struggling with just trying to make the next move and make the next step and like go through the air vent.
Right. The other thing, I feel like in the book you really feel Leland's age.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It kind of weighs on you throughout the novel,
mm-hmm.
where he gets injured and stuff in the movie, but I don't quite feel the heaviness of it. Like, I feel like there's, I don't know if it's just the levity of the movie or.
I think it is the levity of the movie because he looks exhausted. He looks tired. He looks kind of beaten down, but we don't have that internal dialogue we have in the book.
No, in the movie, I really felt the exhaustion and being beat down and the emotional toll of killing people in one-on-one combat.
You mean in the book?
In the book, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Okay.
All right. So James and Alexander use anti-tank missiles to disable a SWAT armored car before McClane violently kills both of them.
The SWAT was fucking useless.
I don't even remember it.
Okay, continue.
Violently kills both of them by pushing C4 attached to an office chair and computer down the elevator shaft, blowing up their floor, which I thought was fucking awesome.
It's really great.
Holly's coworker, Harry Ellis, who is the obligatory 80s douchebag cokehead.
I was going to say dickweed, but that works.
Dickweed also. He attempts to mediate between Hans and McClane for the return of the detonators. McClane refuses, prompting Gruber to execute Ellis. Thank God, because...
Right here, when he calls Hans Bubby, that was all ad-libbed. So Alan Rickman's reaction was 100% genuine.
That was...
He played up the dickweed real well.
Here is my question. How do you play that great of a dickweed if you're not actually a dickweed in real life?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's... Ooh.
You're either a great actor or you're a dickweed.
Right, exactly. But that whole scene where they're together and Ellis is trying to, like, basically negotiate a deal. I loved how we as the audience knew he was in way over his head and he had no idea.
Were you kind of happy that he died, though?
I was so happy. He was such a turd.
Go Hans.
That's the thing about Hans in the movie is there's points at which you root for him.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that levity.
100%.
So... While checking explosives attached to the roof, Gruber encounters McClane. Gruber passes himself off as an escaped hostage. McClane offers him a gun, and Gruber attempts to shoot McClane, but the gun is empty. Carl...
Bum, bum, bum!
Carl, Franco, and Fritz arrive. McClane kills Fritz and Franco, but is forced to flee, abandoning the detonators.
James Franco. I'm just kidding.
Well, when you said that, I could totally see him being in this movie.
Another little tidbit from the movie. That scene actually where Hans and McClane meet wasn't actually written in until they heard Alan Rickman do his American accent. Because they wanted them to meet before the final showdown.
Oh, okay.
And so once they found out he could do that, it was kind of written in.
That makes me happy because I love Alan Rickman.
Me too.
Alan Rickman. I just always think about that scene in Love Actually when he's at the counter with Mr. Bean and he's trying to get that fucking gift for his pretend mistress. Mm-hmm. Cover it in chocolate buttons. Anyway, FBI agents take command of the siege, ordering the building's power shut off. This, as Gruber anticipated, disables the vault's final lock.
I will say I really like the FBI being... The FBI is not in the book, so it's in the movie, and I really like it. It adds some great hilarity, and their names are Johnson and Johnson.
Do you want to hear something even better?
Yes.
Okay, so one of the Johnsons is also one of the Fratellis from Goonies.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The casting director... This woman, she chose the best fucking douches for this movie, I swear to God. I don't know if she's a woman, but I'm assuming she is because she knows what she's
What's
doing.
What's her name?
I don't know. I just am assuming.
Then you don't know it's a woman.
I don't know. I just want to believe it is.
You can't say that.
Also, their names are Big Johnson and Little Johnson.
So that's a total dick reference.
Big Dick, Little Dick. It could be a children's book, let's be honest.
That's so great. I'm so happy right now. Oh, the casting director is Jackie Birch.
It is a woman. Casting directors are always women because we know human beings so well.
We know how to spot a big and little dick from far away.
We can read all the signs.
Okay.
Okay.
So the book and the movie kind of take a different turn here. In the novel, I feel like little Tony is much colder and conniving than Hans Gruber is.
Yeah.
They very much play a cat and mouse game throughout all of it. And he actually breaks fluorescent lights on the stairs because he knows Leland is barefoot.
Oh, God, that's so horrible.
And in the movie, Hans kind of gets like this light bulb moment, this fluorescent light bulb moment. And he shoots out all the glass. And so that John McClane will have to run across it. And he cuts his feet up really bad.
Yeah, it's like painful to even think about.
This leads to a very, I feel like, emotional scene. And I think this really sets the quote unquote character transformation for making this a Christmas movie for me. Mm-hmm. Because John McClane really, he's talking to Al Powell and he...
It sounded like you said Owl Powell. Sorry.
Owl Power.
Anyway, go ahead.
Al Powell, and he talks about like how sorry he is and to tell his wife he's sorry. Mm. He really has this like emotional cleansing.
Oh, yeah.
And Al tells him about like why he's on the desk and he shot and killed a kid.
Ooh.
And let's flash forward to 2018.
Yikes. And
it brings up a whole new thing. But
yeah.
Anyway, I think it brings this movie some emotional depth that I don't think happens without this moment.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I think it really connects these two men in a great way.
Yeah, it's it really does. Because they're working so hard, but they, you know, they can't really like reach out to each other. They don't get to see mm-hmm. each other face to face. Like, yeah.
Also, when he's pulling the glass out of his feet, it like gives me the ugh feeling.
I don't even want to think about it.
You know what feeling I'm talking about? Like in the pit of your stomach where you just like cringe.
Yeah, because it seems so painful. I fell into a cactus once and it was a lot. That's the kind of feeling that you get.
I don't know how they filmed this, but it gave me the heebie-jeebies.
I get that feeling every time I watch that scene in Home Alone where where the tall guy steps on the nail on the stair. Oh, I can barely watch it.
Or in A Quiet Place.
I don't remember that.
She steps on the
Oh,
on
yeah,
the
and
nail.
She can't
She's pregnant.
Scream.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. Gruber demands a helicopter on the rooftop for transport, but the FBI prepare to double-cross him by sending helicopter gunships. McClane discovers that Gruber intends to detonate the explosives on the roof, which would fake the deaths of his team so they can escape with the bearer bonds. While making final preparations, Gruber sees a news report by intrusive reporter and fuckface... Richard Thornburg that features McClane's children, and Gruber deduces from a desk photo that McClane is Holly's husband. So it's been hidden this whole time that they all know McClane's in the building, but it's been hidden this whole time that he's Holly's husband.
Yeah, at work she just goes by her maiden name, Gennaro.
Right.
So
the criminals order the hostages to the roof, but Gruber takes Holly with him to use against McClane, who in the meantime defeats Carl in a fight before heading up to the roof, killing Yuli in the process. And if nobody remembers, Yuli is the Asian mullet guy.
Okay, because I don't remember Yuli. I actually didn't know half of these people's names.
I didn't know any of their names. I just remember them like, oh, I've seen... him as a villain or a douchebag in some other movie.
I only knew Carl and Hans.
I don't know. Carl's the long-haired blonde guy, right?
Yeah, the... Yeah.
Oh, you knew his name.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. So, he sends the hostages downstairs just as the FBI appear and start shooting at McClane, believing him to be a terrorist. Gruber then detonates the explosives, destroying the roof and the FBI helicopter. McClane barely manages to survive.
Yes, this was a great scene in the movie, and this was a great scene taken a little differently in the book. Mm-hmm. They blow the helicopters up with, I believe, grenade launchers, rocket launchers?
Yeah, something like that, RPG of some kind.
I do like that a lot of the main action in the movie is taken straight from the book, which I think is great.
Oh, yeah. Because it's the most straightforward thing in the book.
It really is.
Did you happen to notice when Holly is with Gruber, why is her blouse suddenly undone? Did you notice that?
Because a man was directing her.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing.
I don't know.
Well, yeah. She's got these beautiful, tasteful undergarments. I love them. They're super professional.
Because they needed another insertion of boobs.
But we've already seen full tits. Why do we need lace?
I don't know.
Just a question. I was like, did the explosion blow her blouse open? I don't know.
Because this all of a sudden became a bodice ripper.
You can kind of see her as the damsel in distress there. Like, she needs...
With Carl.
He's our whatever that guy's name is.
Fabio.
Thank you. Okay.
Do people know Fabio now outside of the butter commercials? Like, I can't believe it's not butter things.
I don't think they even know that. Because we're old, so.
Yeah. I've just placed myself well into my 30s.
There you go. Firmly in your 30s, sister.
I am barely in my 30s. Fuck you.
As long as you stay 11 days older than me, I'm cool with it. Okay. Theo, whoever.
Wait, did you have something?
All I was going to say was, I feel like in addition to greed, the 80s really saw bureaucrats as serious villains. You've got the deputy chief, who's a total dingleberry. And by the end, of the movie, he's basically a bystander and totally useless. But I don't know why I put that there. It should have been somewhere else.
I feel like throughout this whole movie, they are really making fun of authority figures.
They are.
So they're all just fuckwads.
It's so great. I love it. I think that's like a... And the deputy chief, he played the fucking principal in fucking Breakfast Club. So talk about the ultimate dingleberry. That's him.
I want to start using dingleberry in everyday conversation.
It's perfect.
What a dingleberry. Is that a cereal? No.
No, it's not a cereal. And if it was, I hope nobody would buy it.
Is there kind of some kind of cereal that starts with a D?
That one with
dickweed cereal?
Dickweeds are for kids.
Now in Fred Fun Fruit Shakes.
But so amazing.
I'm so sorry. I apologize.
Don't apologize for being yourself. Never apologize for who you are.
Wait, I'm typing this into search. Dingleberry cartoons, dingleberry cereal, dingleberry crunch.
Please tell me there's not a dingleberry crunch.
I don't think it's a real thing, but it is on Reddit.
My stomach hurts so bad. That is not okay. Oh, before I forget, I was thinking of Dunkaroos when you said, is there a cereal that starts with D? We are professionals. Okay. Professional what?
Hookers. Dingleberries.
Casey and Abby, professional dingleberry hookers. Okay. What were we talking about?
Anyway.
So.
Back to Theo. We never talked about Theo.
Who the fuck is Theo?
So he is the funny black man.
Oh, I actually liked him a lot.
I like him too.
He was humming a song in the beginning that I swear to God I know, but I can't think of what it was.
I really like when he does his, "'Twas the night before Christmas and all through the house, the SWAT team was coming two by two," or whatever.
That's cute. I don't remember it, but okay. That's great.
All right. Okay. Anyway.
Theo retrieves their getaway vehicle, but is incapacitated by Argyle.
Go, Argyle!
A weary McLean finds Holly with Gruber and his remaining men, Eddie and Kristoff. After knocking Kristoff unconscious, he confronts Gruber and is ordered to surrender his machine gun. McLean does this to spare Holly, but distracts Gruber and Eddie, allowing him to grab a concealed pistol with only two bullets taped to his back. So the pistol is taped to his back. The bullets are in the gun. I assume. Yes. Okay.
I believe they're taped to his back with some kind of Christmas
tape.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I think it has like a holiday design on it.
Perfect.
To really punch home that this is a Christmas movie.
You gotta punch it home.
For all the dingleberries in the audience.
Please don't start again. Okay. McLean shoots Gruber and kills Eddie with a single shot to the forehead.
Ba-tunk. Pew, pew!
Gruber crashes through a window but grabs onto Holly's wrist. Gruber raises a pistol and attempts to shoot him, but McLean removes Holly's wristwatch and Gruber falls to his death.
Okay, so before we get into the book, I have another movie tidbit. They told Alan Rickman that they were going to drop him on 3, and they dropped him on 1.
That is fucked up.
First, way dick move. However, it is a great scene.
He does look genuinely surprised.
Can you imagine how pissed you would be?
Poor Alan so Rickman. Pissed. He gets called Bubby. He gets fucking dropped.
His first feature film he's ever in. I would be so mad.
He probably was like super professional on set and didn't say anything.
I left the stage for this bullshit.
He probably went home and talked so much shit and was like this director's right? office goddamn rocker. Oh, poor Alan. Okay. All right.
I have a couple things. So in the book, Stephanie is really up to her neck in illegal activities and... I mean, she's sleeping with Ellis. She's doing some cocaine. She's involved in this arms deal.
Like any strong 80s woman would be.
Right, of course. And, you know, so Joe Leland talks throughout the book that he knows Stephanie is really fucking up, but she's an adult. She has to make her own choices. And this really hit home how, for me, how parents have to be, like, you know your kids are messing up, but you also know that they have to make those mistakes.
Right. You do them a disservice if you step in too much.
Right. And the more you say to them, the more they resent you and they'll just stop talking to you. Okay. I just think as a parent, it has to be really hard to know.
With coke like, and guns, yeah, it's got to be rough.
So when you walk in and you see your kid with a dollar bill up their nose, you know they're fucking up, but you have to like step back.
I kind of think that's like the situation where you do say something though.
Okay, well he doesn't.
Right, because she's an adult and she's a strong woman. Anyway.
There is a major difference from the book to the movie. In the book, he does not pull the watch off of Stephanie and she falls to her death with Gruber.
Because of the watch.
And I kept rereading the scene over and over because I'm so used to the movie. I didn't think she was actually dead. Like, I was like, oh, she's probably hanging on the window below.
Oh, right.
Nope. She's dead.
Welcome to nihilism.
So in Roderick Thorpe's his LA Times obituary that I was reading, they said that throughout all of his success, he was an unassuming man who smoked plain wrapped cigarettes, drove nondescript cars, and he once said money probably wouldn't change his no-frills habit. He was quoted as saying, "The quality of my life isn't in shopping for gold-plated cars. I value friendship, loyalty, truthfulness, and honor."
That's really sweet.
He said, "I don't care whether the neighbors know I've made it or not." And so I thought this kind of played into how her greed is her downfall. And he was really a simple man.
Yeah.
I really liked it.
That's really... Are you crying?
No.
Oh. Sounded like you were crying.
I have a black heart, bitch.
My only thing is, like, it's fine. I mean, I personally think it's totally fine if nice things are something you pursue, and if you really love expensive eyeliner or whatever, like I do.
I think,
but it can't be your number one motivator.
No, and if you're making the money to spend it, great, but she clearly wasn't making enough for all that she had.
Right, and it fucked her over.
And I think it got her in the end.
When I was reading this ending, I was like, I bet Thorpe wrote this entire fucking book just to use this watch as a metaphor against corporate greed. I was like, he thought of that someday while he was drinking coffee, and he was like, wait till I whip this thing out on these fuckers. And I normally think that's a little... What?
When he whipped this thing out, not his dick.
Not his penis. I would normally think that's a little melodramatic, but I actually really liked it in the movie and the book. I liked that the watch was, like, important, but it was small, mm-hmm. and I thought that was great.
It's brought up in the very beginning of the book and the movie in such, like, a slight... way,
uh-huh.
and then it plays such a major role later. I really liked it.
Yeah, life and death literally teeters on this little watch. Item. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I do like, I think it's interesting how they both took a very different approach to the watch.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay.
So yeah, that's a big motivation. And one of the big, like, inspirations for that would have been the greed that, you know, LA itself represents. I had read an article that said he wrote the movie and the book. I'm sorry, he wrote the book while living in Laurel Canyon. I think we talked about this. His house was overlooking a high-rise building on the Wilshire Corridor, which potentially could have been the Union Bank Plaza.
Okay.
And it definitely could have been the inspiration since it's exactly 40 stories. So it fits the...
I did not know that. I know that the building they use in the movie is actually Fox Studios' headquarters.
That's amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you say it wasn't finished at the time that they filmed it?
Yeah, it wasn't completely finished, and they rented it out to themselves. So someday I'm going to have enough houses that I'm going to rent myself a vacation house.
You're going to rent yourself, your corporation, your vacation house for functions?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so ending of this movie. Outside, McLean and Holly meet Powell. Carl emerges and attempts to shoot McLean, but is shot dead by Powell with his police revolver. Argyle crashes through the parking garage door in the limo. Thornburg arrives and attempts to interview McLean, but Holly punches him before she and McLean leave the area with Argyle.
Mm-hmm.
Al can finally kill people again. What a beautiful Hollywood ending.
I know, you're really supposed to root for him here.
It's like when this washed up sports guy can play sports again, just with guns.
And murder.
Right. Well, it's not really murder, but yeah.
It's not
but murder. It's killing a human. Also, the reporter is played by William Atherton. Has he ever played any role that wasn't completely despicable? Let's be honest.
I don't know who he is.
Ghostbusters, the guy that's like the bureaucrat in that, where he's like, oh, he, I think he works with the EPA or okay. something.
Okay.
You know what's funny is I was thinking to myself, I bet in real life he's like the most, like the sweetest, most charitable human. But in movies, mm-hmm. you see his face and you're like, yep, that guy is the enemy of all good things.
Probably.
Here at the end, we see Powell and McLean embrace, and it's such a sweet moment. They've been working together and trying to defeat the villains with only radios connecting them. And now they finally get to meet and connect face to face as two humans.
Right. The bearer bonds snow down from the sky.
It's such a beautiful moment.
I would say rain, but I think it's supposed to mimic snow.
So. I love that.
Because it's a Christmas movie.
Right. I love that. And I didn't even make that connection. But I really like this moment in the movie. And the book was quite a bit more nihilistic, I think.
I agree.
Leland's connection and lack of connection are huge in the book, like connection with other people. So he feels horrible for killing, but his desire to get vengeance on these people is really overpowering as well. He wants to kill them all because of how much they've made him and his family suffer. Mm-hmm. He has to kill to survive, but he also kind of loves it. Let's be honest.
I think by the end, he's into it.
Totally. And I think a lot of that comes, well, part of it comes from the military service and being a cop. And there, you know, because there's parts of your humanity that you literally have to turn off in order to do the job.
Right.
And that thing I watched about D-Day, I don't know if I think I brought it up already. I watched this thing. It's like a docudrama about D-Day. It's narrated by Ian, whatever his name is, from Lord of the Rings, who plays Bilbo Baggins.
Okay.
Anyway, that made me think about this. You know, they're kids, they're terrified, but they still had a job to do. So they had to kind of push aside their own humanity to do it. Mm-hmm. And I keep trying really, really hard not to compare this to I Am Legend because Leland and Neville had so many similarities.
Ian Holm.
Thank you, Ian Holm.
Sorry. But yes, I did definitely see the connections, including alcoholism.
Ooh. Forgot about that part. Mm-hmm. Connections to Neville and us. Well, I mean, you know, we're...
Sorry, my alcohol-soaked brain took a minute to get it.
There you go. We're casual alcoholics. Sorry, that's offensive. I apologize.
Yeah, we're not Meredith Palmer.
Well, I mean, I am, but...
I mean, you look just like her, but...
Identical.
Okay. Something for the end of the book... It's not clear to me if Leland survives. He's much worse off in the book.
Yeah.
And he has to be carried out of the building. And then he gets shot one last time by Carl, where Carl also kills some reporters and a doctor helping.
Did he kill the main reporter? Because that guy was a turd.
I don't remember.
Okay.
The last line of the novel is, Leland closed his eyes. Now and for a little while longer, he was going to think of flying. And so I know he talked about like having a reason to live and possibly raising his grandchildren, but there's not a follow-up novel, so I don't feel like it's clear that he does survive or he doesn't. And in my head, I think he dies.
I like that reading of it. I think it fits with the rest of the narrative.
I don't have like a firm answer on this.
Right.
So I think you could take it either way.
It's definitely open-ended. Think yeah.
My little black heart likes him dead.
I didn't even think about that until you brought it up. I assumed he lived.
Okay.
But I like the fact that he could have died or that he did die.
I definitely see where most people would take it as he lived. I think I like to take the darker road.
There we go.
So.
I want to go down that road with you.
Okay. Welcome to the pedophiles and death.
Oh, God.
Flashback to the turn of the screw.
Oh, yeah. There's no pedophiles that I know of in this book.
No.
Okay.
Just lots of boobs.
Boobs. Okay.
Are you good?
I'm good. I have final thoughts ready if you do.
I have final thoughts ready.
You go first.
All right. My final thoughts on this. Even with the radical differences, they both work together greatly. The book and the movie stand perfectly on their own and neither one detracts from the other. Mm-hmm. The novel is much darker with themes of guilt, regret, alcoholism, and just being in Joe Leland's mind the entire time is a really dark place to be.
Yeah.
The movie has great comedic moments that help break up the action, and I really like a lot of the one-liners that he says throughout it.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a good reprieve.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And I am much, like, the movie left me with a much more satisfied feeling.
Okay.
I still would recommend the book. Like, if you enjoy this movie, I recommend that you read this book.
Okay.
And if you haven't watched the movie, I don't know where you've been living. So.
Can I be honest?
Like, you're... Yeah. You've never watched this before, have you?
I mean, I've never seen it all the way through before.
Oh, my God. Okay. I have never met anyone who hasn't watched this, so...
I had seen pieces of it, but I don't know. I don't have an excuse. I'm sorry.
I feel like it's the ultimate action movie, and there's so many that try to take from it, and just none do it as well as this movie did it.
Yeah, I think this is, like, the action movie. It's entertaining. It's well-written for an action movie. It knows its audience. Mm-hmm. It owns what it is, but it still has a way of paying homage to the source material, which I think would have a slightly different audience. I kind of think about the book as, like, it would probably be guys about Leland's age who would be the first to pick up the book. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that.
But it's really well-paced, the book is. The inner dialogue from Leland is interesting, and it has depth without pontificating, I felt like. I really liked it. And it was also a really quick read.
Yes, it was very quick.
Yeah.
It, like, flew by.
It did.
You could easily finish this in a day or two.
Oh, yeah, totally. If you need a beach read, it's a good beach read. Well, I mean, it's not, like, fun, but it's fast.
With horrible dark themes, racism, and sexism.
Right. So it's my kind of beach read.
Yes, it is yours. Your kind of
The book and the movie complemented each other really well, which I enjoyed that. I liked both of them a lot. I recommend both. Mm-hmm. You need, like, to have that in your repertoire. Read and watch both of them. Mm-hmm. That's all I have to say.
I don't think many people know that Die Hard was a book, and it's right there in the credits. And I actually never noticed it until we started talking about this.
Yeah.
Like, until I really started researching, like, what books we could do for the podcast.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized. So.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't think the book gets the credit that it's due, because it really genuinely is a good book. It's well written. I think it has something to say. Like, it has a cultural, political kind of message. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you can take out of the book, you can read as deep as you want to read.
Yes, that is a perfect way to describe it, because you can read it right on the surface as an action book, or you can
100%.
Yeah, or you can look at it as, like, a socio-political statement.
That is an excellent point.
Thanks.
Good job.
You too.
Thanks. All right. You good?
I'm good.
All right. So please join us next Sunday for our episode of Lit Bits, where we will talk about anything else we've read and watched and any current events. If you're reading along with us, our next book will be The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey, along with the 2016 film by the same name. It will be released in 2 weeks. We would love to hear from you. You can find us on our website at thelitflixpodcast.com. You can email us at thelitflixpodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you want to check out our TBR list, it is on Goodreads. Please rate, review, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Rating us and leaving us a review really does help us out, and we would love to hear what you think.
We really would. That's a genuine request. Like,
yeah.
I want to know what people have to say. Mm-hmm. Start a conversation. 100%. Make a dialogue.
Yes.
Let's do this.
Please.
We need friends.
All right.
So for now, cheers.